Guinevere said violently, "Even Christ in the garden prayed, 'If it be thy will, let this cup pass from me.'"
"But he said also, Gwen, 'Not my will, Lord, be done, but thine,'"
Morgaine reminded her. "I wonder that you know such things."
"I dwelt in Egraine's household for 11 years, Guinevere, and I heard the gospel preached as often as you."
"Yet I cannot see how it should be God's will that the kingdom be torn again by chaos if Arthur should die," Guinevere said, and heard her own voice rise, sharp and angry. "All these years I have been faithful. Yes, I know you do not believe it. I suppose you think what all the women in the court think, that I have betrayed my lord for the love of Lancelot. But it isn't so, Morgaine. I swear it isn't so."
"Guinevere, Guinevere, I'm not your confessor. I have not accused you."
"But you would if you could, and I think you are jealous," Guinevere retorted at white heat, and then cried out in contrition, "Oh, no, no. I do not want to quarrel with you, Morgaine, my sister. Oh, no, I came to beg you for your help."
She felt the tears break from her eyes.
"I have done no wrong. I have been a good and loyal wife. I've kept my lord's house and strove to bring honour to his court. I have prayed for him and tried to do the will of God. I have failed no whit of my duty, and yet, for all of my loyalty and duty, I have not even had my part of the bargain. Every whore in the streets, every soldier's camp follower, they go about flaunting their big bellies and their fruitfulness, and I have nothing, nothing."
She was sobbing wildly, her hands over her face. Morgaine's voice sounded puzzled but tender, and she put out her arms and drew Guinevere to her. "Don't cry, don't cry. Guinevere, look at me. Is it so much a sorrow to you that you have no child?" Guinevere struggled to control her weeping. She said,
"I can think of nothing else, day and night."
After a long time, Morgaine said, "Aye, I can see it is hard for you." It seemed she could actually hear Guinevere's thoughts.
"If I had a child, I would not think night and day of this love which tempts my honour, for all my thoughts would be given to Arthur's son."
"I would that I could help you, sister, but I am unwilling to have doings with charms and magic. We are taught in Avalon that simple folk may need such things, but the wise meddle not with them, but bear the lot the gods have sent them." And as she spoke, she felt herself a hypocrite. She was remembering the morning when she had gone out to find roots and herbs for a potion which would keep her from bearing Arthur's child. But in the end, she hadn't done it either. And then Morgaine wondered in sudden weariness, "I who didn't want a child, and who came near to death in bearing it, I bore my child. Guinevere, who longs night and day for one, goes with empty womb and empty arms. Is this the goodness of the will of the gods?" Yet she felt compelled to say, "Guinevere, I would have you bear this in mind. Charms often work as you would not that they would do. What makes you believe the goddess I serve can send you a son when your god, who is supposed to be greater than all the other gods, cannot?" It sounded like blasphemy, and Guinevere was ashamed of herself. Yet she found herself thinking and saying aloud in a voice that choked as she spoke, "I think perhaps God cares nothing for women. All his priests are men. And again and again the scriptures tell us that women are the temptress and evil. It may be that is why he doesn't hear me. And for this, I would go to the goddess. God does not care." And then she was weeping stormily again. "Morgaine," she cried. "If you cannot help me, I swear I will go tonight to Dragon Island in the boat. I shall bribe my serving man to take me there. And when the fires are lighted, I too shall entreat the goddess to give me the gift of a child. I swear it, Morgaine, that I will do this." And she saw herself in the light of the fires, circling the flames, going apart in the grip of a strange and faceless man, lying in his arms. The thought made her whole body cramp tight with pain and a half-shamed pleasure. Morgaine listened in growing horror. She would never do it. She would lose her courage at the last moment. I was frightened, even I. And I had always known my maidenhead was for the god. But then, hearing the utter despair in her sister-in-law's voice, she thought, "Aye, but she might. And if she did, she would hate herself all her life long." There was no sound in the room but Guinevere's sobbing. Morgaine waited until it quieted a little and said, "Sister, I will do for you what I can. Arthur can give you a child. You need not go to the Beltane fire, or seek one elsewhere. You must never say aloud that I have told you this. Promise me that, and ask me no questions. But Arthur has indeed sired a child." Guinevere stared at her. "He told me he had no children." "It may be that he doesn't know. But I have seen the child myself. He is being fostered at Morgause's court."
"Why, then, he has already a son, and if I do not bear him one..."
"No," said Morgaine quickly, and her voice was harsh. "I have told you, you must never speak of this. The child is not such a one as he could acknowledge. If you give him no child, then must the kingdom go to Gawain. Guinevere, ask me no more, for I will not tell you more than this. If you do not bear, it is not Arthur's fault."
"I have not even conceived since last harvest time, and only 3 times in all these years."
Guinevere swallowed, wiping her face on her veil.
"If I offer myself to the goddess, she will be merciful to me."
Morgaine sighed.
"It might be so.
You must not go to Dragon Island. You can conceive, I know. Perhaps a charm could help you to carry a child to birth. But I warn you again, Guinevere. Charms do not their magic as men and women would have it, but by their own laws, and those laws are as strange as the running of time in the fairy country. Do not seek to blame me, Guinevere, if the charm acts other than you think it should.
If it gives me even a slight chance of a child by my lord..."
"That it should do," Morgaine said, and turned, Guinevere following after her like a child being led by her mother. What would the charm be, Guinevere wondered, and what would it do? And why did Morgaine look so strange and solemn, as if she were that great goddess herself? But, she told herself, taking a deep breath, she would accept whatever came, if it might give her what she desired most. An hour later, when the trumpets were blown and Morgaine and Guinevere were sitting side by side at the edge of the field, Elaine leaned over to them and said,
"Look, who is that riding into the field at Gawain's side?"
"It is Lancelot," said Guinevere breathlessly. "He has come home."
He was handsomer than ever. Somewhere he had gotten a red slash on his cheek, which should have been ugly, but it gave him the fierce beauty of a wild cat. He rode as if he were part of the horse's self, and Guinevere listened to Elaine's chatter, not really hearing, her eyes fixed on the man.
Bitter, bitter the irony of this. Why now, when I am resolved and pledged to think no more of him, but to do my sworn duty by my lord and king?
Round her neck, beneath the golden torque Arthur had given her when they had been wedded a full 5 years, She could feel the weight of Morgaine's charm sewn into a little bag between her breasts. She didn't know, hadn't wanted to know, what Morgaine had put into it.
Why now?
I had hoped that when he came home for Pentecost, I should be already bearing my lord's child, and he would look no more on me, since it was so clear I was resolved to honour my marriage. Yet against her will she remembered Arthur's words.
Should you bear me a child, I would not question. Do you know what I am saying to you?
Guinevere had known what he meant all too well. Lancelot's son could be heir to the kingdom. Was this new temptation offered her now because she had already fallen into grievous sin by meddling with Morgaine's sorcery, and making wild and unchaste threats, hoping to force Morgaine into helping her?
I do not care. If so be it, I can bear my king a son.
If a god would damn me for that, what have I to do with him? She was frightened at her own blasphemy. Yet it had been blasphemy, too, to think of going to the lighted Beltane fires. Look, Gawain is down. Even he could not stand against Lancelot's riding, Elaine said eagerly. And Kai, too. How could Lancelot strike down a lame man?
Don't be more of a fool than you must, Elaine, said Morgaine. Do you think Kai would thank Lancelot for sparing him? If Kai went into these games, surely he is able to risk whatever hurt he could take. No one bade him compete.
It had been foreordained from the moment Lancelot took the field who would win the prize. There was some good-natured grumbling among the companions when they saw it.
"There's no use in any of us entering the lists at all while Lancelot is here," Gawain said, laughing, his arm around his cousin. "Couldn't you have stayed away another day or so, Lance?"
Lancelot was laughing too, a high colour in his face. He took the golden cup and tossed it in the air.
"Your mother too besought me to stay in her court for Beltane. I came not here to defraud you of the prize. I have no need of prizes. Guinevere, my lady," he cried, "take this, and give me instead the ribbon you wear about your neck. The cup may go to the altar or to the queen's high table."
Embarrassed, Guinevere's hand flew to her throat and the ribbon on which she had tied Morgaine's charm.
"This I may not give you, my friend."
But she fumbled at the sleeve which she had embroidered with small pearls.
"Take this for a kindness to my champion. As for the prize, well, I will give prizes to all of you."
She gestured to Gawain and Gareth, who had come in after Lancelot in the riding.
"Graciously done," Arthur said, rising in his place, while Lancelot took the embroidered silk and kissed it, then fastened it around his helm. "But my most valiant fighter must still be honoured. You will sit with us at the high table, Lancelot, and tell us all that has befallen you since you left my court."
Guinevere excused herself with her ladies, the better to prepare for the feast. Elaine and Melias were chattering about Lancelot's valour, his riding, his generosity in giving up all claim to the prize. Guinevere could think only of the look he had given her when he begged her for the ribbon about her throat. She looked up and met Morgaine's dark, enigmatic smile.
"I cannot even pray for peace of mind. I have forfeited the right to pray."
For the first hour of the feast, she was moving about, making sure that all of the guests were properly seated and served. By the time she took her seat at the high table, they were drunk, most of them, and it was very dark outside. The servants brought lamps and torches, fastening them into the wall, and Arthur said jovially,
"See, my lady, we are lighting our own Beltane fire within walls."
Morgaine had come to sit close to Lancelot. Guinevere's face throbbed with heat and the wine she had drunk. She turned away so that she might not see them. Lancelot said with a great yawn,
"Why, it is Beltane indeed. I had forgotten." And Guinevere had it that we must have a feast, so that none of our folk would be tempted to slip away into the old rites, Arthur said. There are more ways to skin a wolf than chasing him out of his fur. If I forbade the fires, then would I be a tyrant.
And, Morgaine said in her low voice, faithless to Avalon, my brother.
But if my lady makes it more pleasant for my people here to sit at our feast instead of going out into the fields to dance by the fires, then is our purpose achieved more simply.
Morgaine shrugged. To Guinevere it seemed that she was secretly amused. She had drunk but little. Perhaps she was the only wholly sober person at the king's table.
"You have been travelling in Lothian, Lancelot. Do they keep the Beltane rites there?"
"So says the Queen," Lancelot said. "But for all I know, she may have been jesting with me. I saw nothing to suggest that Queen Morgause is not the most Christian of ladies."
But it seemed to Guinevere that he glanced uneasily at Gawain as he spoke.
"Mark what I say, Gawain. I said nothing against the Lady of Lothian. I have no quarrel with you or yours."
But only a soft snore answered him, and Morgaine's laughter was brittle.
"Look, yonder lies Gawain asleep with his head on the table. I too would ask news of Lothian, Lancelot.
I do not think anyone reared there could so quickly forget the Beltane fires. The sun tides run in the blood of anyone reared on Avalon, like me, like Queen Morgause. Is it not so, Lancelot?"
"Arthur, do you remember the king-making on Dragon Island? How many years ago? 9? 10?
Arthur looked displeased, though he spoke gently enough.
"That is many years past and gone, as you say, sister, and the world changes with every season. I think the time for such things is past, save perhaps for those who live with fields and crops, and must call on the goddess for their blessing. Taliesin would say so, and I will not gainsay it. But I think those old rites have little to do with such as we who dwell in castles and cities and have heard the word of Christ."
He raised his wine-cup, emptied it, and spoke with drunken emphasis.
"God will give us all we desire, all that is right for us to have, without need to call upon the old gods. Is it not so, Lance?"
Guinevere felt Lancelot's eyes on her for a moment before he said,
"Which of us has all the things he may desire, my king? No king. And no god can grant that. But I want my subjects to have all they need," repeated Arthur thickly. "So does my queen, giving us our own Beltane fires here."
"Arthur," said Morgaine gently, "you are drunk."
"Well, and why not?" he asked her belligerently. "At my own feast, and my own fire? What else did I fight the Saxons for all those years? Sit here at my own round table and enjoy the peace. Good ale and wine and good music. Where's Kevin the harper? Am I to have no music at my feast?"
Lancelot said, laughing,
"I have no doubt he has gone to worship the goddess at her fires, and to play his harp there on Dragon Island." "Why, this is treason!" said Arthur thickly. "There's another reason to forbid the Beltane fires, so I may have music."
Morgaine laughed and said light-heartedly, "You cannot command the conscience of another, my brother. Kevin is a druid, and has the right to offer his music to his own gods if he will." She leaned her chin on her hands, and Guinevere thought she looked like a cat licking cream from her whiskers.
"But I think he has already kept Beltane in his own way. No doubt he has gone to his bed, for all the company here is too drunken to tell the difference between his harping and mine and Gawain's howling pipes. Even as he sleeps, he plays the music of Lothian," she added, as a particularly raucous snore from the sleeping Gawain cut the silence. And she gestured to one of the chamberlains,
who went and persuaded Gawain to his feet. He bowed groggily to Arthur and staggered from the hall. Lancelot raised the cup in his hand and drained it.
"I too have had enough of music and feasting. I think I have ridden since before daylight, since I would come to your games this day. And soon, I think, I will beg leave to be away to my bed, Arthur."
Guinevere gauged his drunkenness by that off-handed Arthur. In public he was always very careful to speak formally to Arthur as my lord or my king, and only when they were alone did he say cousin or Arthur. But indeed, so late in the feast, there were few sober enough to notice. They might as well have been alone together. Arthur didn't even answer Lancelot. He had slipped down a little in his high seat, and his eyes were half closed. Well, Guinevere thought, he had said it himself. It was his own feast, and his own fireside. And if a man couldn't be drunken in his own house, why had he fought so many years to make their feasts safe and secure? And if Arthur should be too drunk tonight to welcome her to his bed after all? She could feel the ribbon about her neck where the charm hung, and its weight heavy and hot between her breasts. 'Tis Beltane. Could he not keep sober for that? Had he been bidden to one of those old pagan feasts he would have remembered, she thought, and her cheeks burned with the immodesty of the thought. I must be drunk too. She looked angrily at Morgaine, cool and sober, toying with the ribbons of her harp. Why should Morgaine smile like that? Lancelot leaned toward her and said, I think our lord and king has had enough of feasting and wine, my queen. Will you dismiss the servants and companions, madam, and I'll find Arthur's chamberlain to help him to his bed. Lancelot rose. Guinevere could tell he was drunk too, but he carried it well, moving with only a little more carefulness than usual. As she began to pass among the guests to bid them good night, she felt her own head swim and her steps unsteady. Seeing Morgaine's enigmatic smile, she could still hear the words of the damnable sorceress. Do not seek to blame me, Guinevere, if the charm acts other than you think it should. Lancelot came back through the guests streaming out of the hall.
I can't find my lord's body servant. Someone in the kitchen said they were all away to Dragon Island for the fires. Is Gawain still here? Or Balin? They are the only ones big and strong enough to carry our lord and king to his bed.
Gawain was too drunk to carry himself, Guinevere said, and I saw not Balin at all. And for sure you cannot carry him, for he is taller and heavier than you.
Still, I'll have at it, said Lancelot, laughing, and bent beside Arthur. Come, cousin, Gwydion. There's nothing to carry you to bed. I'll give you my arm. Here, come up. There's my brave fellow, he said, as if he spoke to a child.
And Arthur opened his eyes and staggered to his feet. Lancelot's steps were none too steady either, thought Guinevere, as she followed the men. Nor, for that matter, were her own. A fine sight they must look, if any servants were sober enough to notice. High King and High Queen, and the King's Captain of Horse all staggering to bed on Beltane Eve, too drunk for their feet to carry them. But Arthur sobered a little when Lancelot hauled him over the threshold of their room. He went to a ewer of water in the corner, splashed some on his face, and drank more.
Thank you, cousin, he said, his voice still slow and drunken. My lady and I have much for which to thank you, that is certain. And I know you love us both well. God is my witness to that, said Lancelot.
But he looked at Guinevere with something like despair.
Shall I go and find one of your servants, cousin? No. Stay a moment, Arthur said. There is something I would say to you, and if I find not the courage for it now in drink, I shall never say it sober. Gwen, can you manage without your women? I have no mind that this should be carried beyond this chamber by idle tongues. Lancelot, come here and sit by me.
And sitting on the edge of the bed, he stretched out his hand to his friend.
You too, sweeting. Now listen to me both. Guinevere has no child. And do you think I have not seen how you two look at each other? I spoke of this once to Gwen, but she is so modest and pious, she would not hear me. Yet now, at Beltane, when all life on this earth seems to cry out with breeding and fertility. How can I say this? There is an old saying among the Saxons. A friend is one to whom you will lend your favourite wife and your favourite sword.
Guinevere's face was burning. She couldn't look at either of the men. Arthur went on slowly.
A son of yours, Lance, would be heir to my kingdom. And better that than it should go to Lot's sons. Oh, yes, Bishop Patricius would call it grievous sin, no doubt. As if his god were some elderly chaperone who went about at night looking to see who slept in whose bed. I think it greater sin to make no provision for a son to inherit my kingdom. Then should we fall into such chaos as threatened before Uther came to the throne. My friend, my cousin, what do you say?
Guinevere saw Lancelot moisten his lips with his tongue, and she felt the dryness of her own mouth. At last he said,
I know not what to say, my king, my friend, my cousin. God knows, there is no other woman on this earth.
And his voice broke. He looked at Guinevere, and it seemed she couldn't endure the naked longing in his eyes. For a moment she thought she would swoon away, and put out a hand to steady herself on the bed frame. I'm still drunk, she thought. I am dreaming this. I cannot have heard him say what I thought I heard. And she felt an agonizing burst of shame. It seemed she couldn't live and let them speak of her like this. Lancelot's eyes hadn't moved from hers.
It is for my lady to say.
Arthur held out his arms to her. He had drawn off his boots and the rich robe he had worn at the feast. In his undertunic, he looked very like the boy she had wedded years ago. He said,
Come here, Gwen, and drew her down on his knee. You know I love you well. You and Lance, I think, are the two I love best in the world, save for...
He swallowed and stopped, and Guinevere thought suddenly, I have thought only of my own love. I have had no thought for Arthur. He took me unseen, unwanted, and he has shown me love and honoured me as his queen. But I never thought that as I love Lancelot, there may well be one whom Arthur loves and cannot have. Not without sin and betrayal. I wonder if that is why Morgaine mocks me. She knows Arthur's secret loves. Or his sins. But Arthur went on deliberately.
I think I would never have had the courage to say this, were it not Beltane. For many hundreds of years our forefathers have done these things without shame, in the very faces of our gods and by their will. And listen to this, my dearest. If I am here with you, my Guinevere, then should a child come of this, then you may swear, without any untruth, that this child was conceived in your marriage bed. And none of us need ever know for certain. Dear love, will you not consent to this?
Guinevere couldn't breathe. Slowly, slowly, she reached out her hand and laid it in Lancelot's. She felt Arthur's touch on her hair as Lancelot leaned forward and kissed her on the mouth. I have been married many years, and I am as frightened now as any virgin, she thought. And then she remembered Morgaine's words when she laid the charm about her neck.
Beware what you ask for, Guinevere, for the goddess may grant it to you.
At the time, she had thought Morgaine meant only that if she prayed for a child, then she might well die in childbirth. Now she knew it was more subtle than that, for it had come about that she should have Lancelot, and without guilt, with her husband's own will and permission. And in a flash of awareness she thought, it was this I wanted, after all. After all these years, it is certain that I am barren. I will bear no child, but I will have had this, at least. With shaking hands she undid her gown. It seemed that the whole world had dwindled down to this perfect awareness of herself, of her own body aching with desire, a hunger she had never believed she could feel. Lancelot's skin was so soft. She had thought all men were like Arthur, sunburnt and hairy, but his body was as smooth as a child's. Oh, but she loved them both. Loved Arthur all the more that he could be generous enough to give her this. They were both holding her now, and she closed her eyes and put up her face to be kissed, not knowing for certain which man's lips closed over hers. But it was Lancelot's hand that stroked her cheek, moved down to her naked throat where the ribbon clung. "Why, what's this, Gwen?" he asked, his mouth against hers. "Nothing," she said. "Nothing. Some rubbish Morgaine gave me."
She pulled it free and flung it into a corner, sinking back into her husband's arms and her lover's.
The End. You've been listening to The High Queen, Book 2 of The Mists of Avalon, by Marion Zimmer Bradley, narrated by Davina Porter. The Mists of Avalon continues with Book 3, The King Stag, also narrated by Davina Porter. You'll find a wide selection of titles, including bestsellers, mysteries, classics, histories, and more, in the Recorded Books catalog. So to order The King Stag, or for a copy of our latest listing, call us toll-free nationwide at 1-800-638-1304. You can order by phone with Visa or MasterCard, or by writing to us, or by faxing us at 410-535-5499. Don't forget to ask about easy 30-day rentals by mail. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader. Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of The King Stag, Book 3 of The Mists of Avalon, by Marion Zimmer Bradley, narrated by Davina Porter. This work, copyrighted 1982 by Marion Zimmer Bradley, is recorded by arrangement with the Scott Meredith Literary Agency. This recording is copyrighted 1993 by Recorded Books Incorporated. As the High Queen came to a close, Lancelot proposed to Guinevere that they run away together. But though their hopeless love torments them, they cannot betray Arthur. Then, on the night of the Beltane Feast, the pagan summer celebration of fertility and birth, Arthur brought the two tragic lovers together in his room and gave his blessing to their union. "I think I would never have had the courage to say this, were it not for Beltane," he said. "For many hundreds of years our forefathers have done these things without shame, in the very faces of our gods and by their will. And, listen to this, my dearest, if I am here with you, my Guinevere, then should a child come of this, then you may swear without any untruth that this child was conceived in your marriage bed, and none of us need ever know for certain. Dear love, will you not consent to this?" And so it came to pass. And now, Book 3 of the Mists of Avalon. The King Stag.
Chapter 1. At this season in Lothian, it seemed the sun hardly went to rest. Queen Morgause wakened as the light began to steal through the hangings, yet it was so early the gulls were hardly astir. But there was already light enough to make out the hairy, well-muscled body of the young man who slept at her side, a privilege he had enjoyed most of the winter. He had been one of Lot's esquires, and had cast longing eyes on the queen even before Lot's death. And in the deathly darkness of this winter past, it was too much to ask that she should sleep alone in the king's cold chamber. It wasn't that Lot had been so good a king, she thought, slotting her eyes against the growing light. But his reign had been long. He had reigned since before Uther Pendragon took the throne, and his people were used to him. There were people well into their middle years who had known no other king. He had been on the throne, she thought, when young Lochlan was born. For that matter, so had she. But that thought was less comfortable, and she flinched away from it. Gawain would have succeeded his father, but Gawain had hardly visited his native land since Arthur's crowning, and the people did not know him. Here in Lothian the tribes were quite content, since there was peace in the land to be ruled by their queen, with her son Agravain at hand, should they need a leader in war. From time out of mind, a queen had ruled over the people, as a goddess had ruled over the gods, and they were content to have it so. But Gawain hadn't left Arthur's side, not even when Lancelot had come north before Beltane. He said to see that the lighthouses had been put in order on the coast so that ships wouldn't be driven onto the rocks. But Morgause supposed, rather, that he came so that Arthur's eyes could see what went on in Lothian, whether there was anyone there at odds with the rule of the High King. She had heard, then, of Igraine's death. Before that, word hadn't come north to Lothian. She and Igraine hadn't been friends when she was younger. She had always envied her older sister her beauty, and had never forgiven her that Vivian had chosen her for Uther Pendragon. She would have made a better High Queen than that ninny, so pliant and pious and loving. And when all was said and done, when the lamp was out, one man was not so different from any other, and all of them were ridiculously easy to manage, foolishly dependent on that thing a woman could offer to them. She had ruled well behind Lot's throne. She would have done better yet with Uther, for she wouldn't have become so stupidly entangled with the priests. Yet when she heard of Igraine's death, she had mourned her sincerely, and wished she had made the time to ride to Tintagel before she died. She had so few women friends now. Her waiting women had mostly been chosen by Lot for their beauty, or their availability to the king, and he cared most for such women as didn't think very much or talk very intelligently. She was, he said once, quite enough in that line. He took her counsel in all things and respected her wit, but when she had borne him 4 royal sons, he went back to what he naturally preferred for his bed, pretty women with little of sense. Morgause had never begrudged him his pleasures, and was just as well pleased to be spared further childbearing. And if she craved babes to play with, there was her fosterling Gwydion, and Lot's women had always been breeding. Gwydion had playmates enough of royal blood. Lochlan stirred at her side, muttered, and sleepily drew her into his arms, and she gave over thinking for the moment. She had missed him. While Lancelot was at court, she had sent Lochlan to sleep among the young men, though for all the difference it had made to Lancelot, she might have kept Lochlan in her bed or slept with the house dog. Well, he was here again. Lot had never begrudged her amusement, any more than she had begrudged him his women. But when the excitement had subsided, and Lochlan had trundled down the stairs to the privy outside, Morgause thought suddenly that she missed Lot. Not that he had ever been particularly good at this kind of sport. He had been old when she married him. But when that was done, he could talk with her intelligently, and she found that she missed the years when they would wake together and lie in bed and talk of all that was to be done, or what befell in the kingdom, or all of Britain. By the time Lochlin came back, the sun was already strengthening, and the air was alive with the crying of gulls. She could hear small sounds down the stairs, and somewhere there was a smell of bannock baking. She pulled him to her for a quick kiss and said, "You must be off, my dear. I want you out of here before Gwydion comes. He's a big boy now. He's beginning to notice things." Lachlan chuckled. "That one. He's been noticing everything since he was out of his nurse's arms. When Lancelot was here, he noticed every move he made, even at Beltane. But I don't think you have to worry. He's not old enough to think of that." "I'm not so certain," Morgor said, and patted his cheek. Gwydion's way was to do nothing until he was sure he wouldn't be laughed at as too young. Self-possessed as he was, he could never bear to be told he was too young for anything. Even when he was 4 years old, he had flown into a rage at being told he couldn't go birds nesting on the cliffs, and had nearly fallen to his death trying to keep up with the older boys. She remembered that occasion, and other similar ones, when she had told him never to do so and so again, and he had set his small dark face and told her, "Aye, but I shall, and you cannot stop me." Her only reply to that had had to be, "You shall not, or I will myself beat you." Not that it mattered whether she beat him or not. It only made him more defiant, unless she was prepared to beat him insensible. And once, losing her temper, she had frightened herself with how hard she had struck the harmless child. None of her own sons, even the strong-willed Gareth, had ever been so defiant. Gwydion took his own way, and did what he would, and so, as he got older, she had taken to subtler methods. "You shall not, or I shall have your nurse take off your beaks and beat you with a heather switch before all the housefolk as if you were a babe of 4 or 5. That had been effective, for a time. Very conscious of his dignity was young Gwydion. But now he did as he would, and there was no stopping him. It would have taken a harsh man to thrash him as hard as was needful. And he had a way of making anyone who offended him sorry for it, soon or late. She supposed that he would be more vulnerable when he began to care what the maidens thought of him. Fairy-born he was, and dark like Morgaine, but handsome enough, even as Lancelot was handsome. And it might be that his outward indifference to the maidens would be the same as Lancelot's. She thought about that for a moment, knowing the sting of humiliation. Lancelot. There was the handsomest man she had seen in many a long year, and she had made it clear to him that even the Queen wasn't beyond his reach. But Lancelot had professed not to understand, had meticulously called her aunt early and late. One would have thought from Lancelot's manner that she was elderly indeed, Vivian's twin, not young enough to be Vivian's daughter. She had begun taking her breakfast in bed while she talked with her women about what must be done that day. While she lingered, propped up on the cushions, they had brought her some of the fresh hot bannock, and there was, at this time of year, plenty of butter from the dairy. Gwydion came into the room. "Good morning, foster mother," he said. "I've been out and brought you some berries. There's cream in the pantry. If you want it, I'll run down and fetch it for you." She looked at the berries, dew fresh, in a wooden bowl. "That was thoughtful of you, foster son," she said, and sat up in bed to take him close in a great hug. When he was only a little younger, he had crawled in beside her into the blankets at such occasions, while she fed him hot bannock and honey, and in winter snuggled him into her furs like any pampered youngster. She missed the feel of the small, warm body burrowing against her, but she supposed he was really too old now. He straightened himself, smoothing his hair into place. He hated to be mussed. Like Morgaine, who had always been a tidy little thing. "You are out early, my love," she said. "And you did all this just for your old foster mother. No, I don't want any cream. You do not want me fat as the old sow, do you?"
He tilted his head to one side like a small, precise bird, and looked, considering, at Morgause.
"It wouldn't matter," he said. "You would still be beautiful, even if you were fat. There are women at this court. Mara, for instance. She is no bigger than you, but all the other women and the men call her Fat Mara. But somehow you do not look as big as you are, because when anyone looks at you, all they see is that you are beautiful. So have the cream if you want it, foster mother."
So precise an answer for a child. But after all, he was beginning to grow into a man. Though he would be like Agravaine, never very tall, one of the old people, a throwback.
And of course, next to the giant Gareth, he would always look like a child, even when he was 20.
He had washed his face and brushed his hair very carefully. Yes, and it had been trimmed freshly, too.
"How nice you look, my love," she said, as his small fingers swooped precisely to appropriate a berry from the dish. "Did you cut your hair yourself?"
"No," he said. "I made the steward do it. I said I was tired of looking like the house dog." Lot was always clean-trimmed and clean-shaven, and so was Lancelot all the time he stayed here. I like to look like a gentleman.
"And so you always do, my dear," she said, looking at the small dark hand holding the berry. It was bramble-scratched, and the knuckles grimed and grubby like any active boy's hand. But she noted, too, that he had scrubbed it long and hard, and that the nails were not dirty and broken, but carefully pared short. "But why have you put on your holiday tunic this morning?"
"Did I put on my holiday tunic?" he asked,
his small dark face innocent.
"Yes, I suppose I did."
"Well?" He paused, and she knew that whatever his reason, and of course he would have a good one, she would never know it.
At last he said calmly,
"I soaked my other one in the dew picking your berries, madam."
And then suddenly he said, "I thought I should hate Sir Lancelot, mother. Gareth talked of him early and late as if he were a god." And Morgause remembered that though he would not weep before her, Gwydion had been heartbroken when Gareth had gone south to King Arthur's court.
Morgause had missed him too. Gareth had been the only person alive who had a real influence with Gwydion, and would make him do as he would with only a light word. Since Gareth had gone, there was no one alive to whose counsel Gwydion would listen.
"I thought he would be a fool, full of his own importance," Gwydion said. "But he's nothing of the sort. He told me more about lighthouses than even Lot knew, I think. And he said, when I was older, I should come to Arthur's court and be made a knight, if I was good and honourable."
His deep-set dark eyes considered that.
"All the women said I looked like him. And they asked, and I was angry that I did not know how to answer them, 'Foster mother,'" he leaned forward, his dark soft hair falling loose over his forehead, lending the composed small face an unusual vulnerability. "Tell me true. Is Lancelot my father? I thought that might be why Gareth was so fond of him."
"And you are not the first to ask that question, my love," she thought, stroking the boy's soft hair.
The unusual childishness in his face as he asked made her voice gentler than usual.
"No, my little one. Of all the men in the kingdom, Lancelot couldn't be your father. I made it my business to ask. All that year you were begotten, Lancelot was in Less Britain, fighting at the side of his father, King Ban.
I thought so too. But you look like him because Lancelot is your mother's nephew, as he is mine.
Gwydion surveyed her sceptically, and Morgause could almost read his thoughts, that she had told him exactly what she would have told him if she had known Lancelot was his father. He said at last,
"Perhaps one day I shall go to Avalon, rather than to Arthur's court." "Does my mother dwell now in Avalon, foster mother?"
"I know not." Morgause frowned.
Once again this oddly adult foster son of hers had led her on to speak to him as if he were a grown man. He did that so often. It came to her that now Lot was gone, Gwydion was the only person in this household with whom she spoke from time to time as one adult to another. Oh, yes, Lochlan was man enough in bed at night, but he never had much more to say than one of the shepherds, or even the housemaids. "Go out now, Gwydion, my love. I'm going to be dressed."
"Why should I go?" he asked. "I've known well enough what you look like, ever since I was 5 years old."
"But you are older now," she said with that old sense of helplessness. "It is not fitting you should be here while I dress."
"Do you care that much what is fitting, foster mother?" he said ingenuously, his eyes resting on the depression in the cushion where Lochlan had lain. And Morgause felt the sudden upward rush of frustration and wrath. He could entangle her in these arguments as if he were a grown man and a druid. She said sharply, "I need not account to you for my doings, Gwydion."
"Did I say you must?"
His eyes were all injured innocence.
"But if I am older, then I will need to know more about women than I did when I was a baby, will I not? I want to stay and talk."
"Oh, stay, stay if you want to," she said. "But turn your back. I'll not have you staring at me, Sir Impudence." Obediently he turned away, but as she rose and signalled her woman to bring her gown, he said,
"No, put on your blue gown, foster mother, the new one from the looms, and your saffron cloak."
"And now you will be giving me advice on what I should wear? What's this? What's this?"
"I like to see you dressed like a fine lady and a queen," he said persuasively. "And tell them to dress your hair high with your gold coil, will you not, foster mother, to please me?"
"Why, you would have me fine as a midsummer feast, so that I should sit and card wool in all my best gear."
"My women would laugh, child." "Let them laugh," Gwydion coaxed. "Will you not dress in your finest to please me? And who knows what may happen before the day is done? You might be glad of it."
Morgause, laughing, gave way.
"Oh, as you wish. If you will have it that I dress myself for a festival, let it be so."
"We will have our own festival here, then.
And now I suppose the kitchen must bake honey cakes for this imaginary festival." "A child after all," she thought. "He thinks in this way to tease for sweets. But then, he brought me berries. Why not?"
"Well, Gwydion, shall I have them bake a honey cake for supper?" He turned around. Her gown was still unlaced, and she saw his eyes linger for a moment on her white breasts. "Not such a child, then." But he said,
"I'm always happy to have a honey cake, but perhaps there will be some fish to bake, too, for dinner."
"If we are to have fish," she said, "you will have to change your tunic again and go fishing for it yourself. The men are busy with the sewing."
He answered quickly, "I will ask Lochlan to go. It will be like a holiday for him." "He deserves one, doesn't he, foster mother? You are pleased with him, aren't you?"
"Idiotic," Morgause thought. "I will not blush before a boy his age."
"If you would like to send Lochlan fishing, love, do so. He can be spared today, I suppose.
And then she thought she would like well to know what was really in Gwydion's mind, with his holiday tunic and his insistence that she should wear her finest gown and provide a good dinner. She called her housekeeper and said, "Master Gwydion would like a honey cake. See to it."
"He shall have his cake," said the housekeeper with an indulgent look at the boy. "Look at his sweet face, like one of those angels he is."
"Angel? That is the last thing I would call him," thought Morgause. But she directed her woman to do her hair up with the gold coil. She would probably never learn what was on Gwydion's mind. The day wore slowly along in its accustomed way. Morgause had wondered at times whether Gwydion had the sight, but he had never shown any of the signs, and once she asked him point blank, he had acted as if he didn't know what she was talking about. And if he had, she thought, at least once she would have caught him bragging of it. Oh, well, for some obscure child's reason, Gwydion had wanted a festival and had coaxed her into it. No doubt with Gareth gone, he was lonely all the time. He had little in common with Lot's other sons. Nor did he have Gareth's passion for arms and knightly things. Nor, as far as she could tell, Morgaine's gift for music, though his voice was clear, and sometimes he would bring out a little set of pipes like those the shepherd lads played, and make strange, mournful-sounding music. But it wasn't a passion as it had been with Morgaine, who would have sat happy all day at her harp, if she could. Still, he had a quick and retentive mind. For 3 years, Lot had sent for a learned priest from Iona to dwell in their house and teach the boy to read. He had said the priest was to teach Gareth too while he was about it, but Gareth had no mind to his book. He struggled obediently with letters and Latin, but no more than Gawain, nor Morgause herself for that matter, could he keep his mind fixed on written symbols or the mysterious tongue of those old Romans. Agravain was quick enough. He kept all the tallies and accounts of the estate. He had a gift for numbering things. But Gwydion soaked up every bit of learning, it seemed, as quickly as it was put before him. Within a year he could read as well as the priest himself, and speak in Latin as if he were one of those old Caesars reborn. So that for the first time, Morgause wondered, might there not be something, after all, in what the Druid said? That we were reborn again and again, learning more and more in each life. "He is such a son as should make his father proud," Morgause thought. "And Arthur has no son at all by his queen. One day, yes, one day I shall have a secret to tell Arthur, and then I can hold the king's conscience in my hand." The thought amused her vastly. She was surprised Morgaine had never used that hold she had on Arthur. She could have forced him to negotiate a marriage for her with the richest of his subject kings, could have had jewels or power. But Morgaine cared nothing for such things, only for her harp and for the nonsense the Druids talked. At least she, Morgause, would make better use of this unexpected power thrust into her hand. She sat in her hall, dressed in her unaccustomed finery, carding the wool from the spring shearing, and making decisions. Gwydion must have a new cloak. He grew so fast his old one was about his knees already, and no good to him in the winter cold. And no doubt he would grow faster yet this year. Should she, perhaps, give him Agravain's cloak, cut down a little, and make a new one for Agravain? Gwydion, in his saffron holiday tunic, came and sniffed appreciatively as the scent of the honey cake, rich with spices, began to drift through the room. But he didn't hang about to tease that it should be cut, and that he should have a slice early, as he would have done only a few months ago. At midday he said, "Mother, I will have a piece of bread and cheese in my hand, and I will be off to walk the boundaries. Agravain said I should go and see if all the fences are in good order." "Not in your holiday shoes," said Morgause. "Certainly not." "I will go barefoot," Gwydion said. unfastening his sandals and leaving them beside her near the hearth. He tucked up his tunic through his belt so that it was well above his knees, took up a stout stick, and was off